Good morning. May it please the court. Nicole Walker on behalf of the appellant, Deshonta Knox. Ms. Knox was convicted by a jury that included an individual who, despite relevant questioning, failed to provide material information that created an impermissible probability of unfairness. Voir dire is designed to expose both known and unknown biases, and challenges for cause or preemptorily are designed to safeguard an individual's right to a fair trial. In our case, during voir dire, the trial court explained to the jury that the state was represented by Mr. Carroll and that Mr. Armstrong represented Ms. Knox. The court then asked, "Do you know the attorneys in this case or any other attorney or employee in the offices of the Attorney General or Defense Counsel?" The future juror number 8 did not come forward or respond, and selection continued primarily based on the information obtained.
Why would the juror have answered, "Yes, I do know an attorney in the Attorney General's office"?
He wouldn't. He would probably answer, "Yes, he did know someone in the Attorney General's office." And the reason for that is, at the time of Ms. Knox's trial, he had a pending case that he was an alleged victim in. And that the conduct in that case had occurred about 6 months earlier. And there was a scheduling order in that case issued in December, and there was subsequently a case review scheduled for January, which was rescheduled for February, a final case review for February, and trial scheduled for less than 2 weeks prior to Ms. Knox's trial. And according to the state and the juror, there was contact, at least to the degree that there was a letter from Victim Services.
Well, but the question is, do you know anyone?
Yes. And that is, are you aware? To know is to aware, personally.
But if you receive a letter, would you think you know the person that sent you the letter?
Yes, to the extent that I know of that person. Now, the problem we have...
Well, that wasn't the question, though. I mean, suppose you get a letter from someone you've never met. You just get a letter from the person, and you're asked a question, "Do you know the person?"
Mm-hmm.
Your answer would be, "No, I don't know them." And you might go on to explain, "I did get a letter from them, I know of them," or something. But if you're just listening to a question, "Do you know a person?"
Mm-hmm.
Would the normal juror be scouring their mind for everyone they got a letter from?
Perhaps not. But the problem we have in this case is that the trial court failed to do a sufficient inquiry. Because,
let's get a basic understanding of how voir dire works. Both counsel, or both sides in a case, for lack of a better term, have an opportunity to request questions from the trial judge. And everyone knows what the standard questions are.
Right.
They can ask that the standard questions be modified.
Mm-hmm.
They can offer wholly new questions. Was that done here?
No, I don't believe so.
But no one said, "Is any member of the jury veneer currently a victim of a crime? Have they ever been a victim of a crime?"
No. And that's not.
And in civil cases, the question's asked, isn't it? Are you now or have you ever been a plaintiff or a defendant in an automobile accident?
Right.
But that question wasn't asked.
No, it wasn't. But that's not relevant, Your Honor, respectfully.
Why isn't it? Because your argument, as I understand it, is focused on the juror failing to do something the juror should have done, or the failure of the trial judge to make an inquiry to know about possible bias on the part of a juror.
That's correct.
Why isn't the focus simply there was a juror who was a victim in a criminal case, and the perception of fairness arising out of this trial is such that we just can't have the administration of justice tolerate a situation where one who's pending working with the Attorney General's office and who considers themselves a victim of a crime, we can't, at a minimum, deprive defense counsel of an opportunity to exercise a peremptory challenge.
And that's correct, and that's the reason that the inquiry by the trial court was insufficient, because under it would have created a valid basis for challenge for cause. And in Hall versus State, where this court found that a Department of Corrections officer on a jury panel had an interest in that he had an interest in deterrence.
But if the focus is on what was not asked, and we understand how cases are litigated, There was no request that anything outside the ordinary be asked. It was as if we acquiesce in the way in which the voir dire is conducted. And then after the fact, we find out, oops, there should have been a more detailed question, or perhaps the question that was asked wasn't specific enough for a layman to respond in the way in which we would have liked them to respond.
Right.
So what do we do about it?
Well, certainly the questions could have been much better. But the argument is they failed to acknowledge that they knew a member of the Attorney General's office. Now, the court's assuming there was the one letter. The problem we have here is that the juror's response was not quite clear, and the trial court in its decision did not make an analysis of his testimony.
Well, I'd like to ask you about how that transpired. I get the impression from reading the record that the juror was deposed.
Yes.
The judge was not present.
No, she was not.
So a subpoena was issued for the juror. The juror shows up at a courthouse with the prosecutor and the defense attorney. Nobody tells the juror what's going on.
No.
And then they start asking the juror questions?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Carroll actually sent a letter, at the court's permission, sent a letter to the alleged victim or the juror and said, we have to resolve this, so you need to come to our offices and depose you. It was done in the Attorney General's office.
Well, I have two concerns. One is, nothing happened for a year. Is there any explanation on the record on why this didn't happen for a year?
No, except there was some indication of some delay, which was that the judge had tried to get the juror in to speak with herself. That didn't happen. Beyond that, there's no indication as to why it took so long.
Well, is there any reported case from Delaware, or do you know of any case where there's been a post-verdict inquiry about a juror where the judge didn't preside?
No. There's not. And in fact, under Rule 24A, the rules of the Superior Court are mandatory, that she must conduct the inquiry herself, and that wasn't done here.
Was it objected to by defense counsel?
No. And in Waters v. State, this court found a violation of a mandatory language despite a failure to object in that case. And we also have an abuse of discretion because the trial court failed to conduct a further investigation. For example, Mr. Carroll is actually a witness to this underlying dispute, and the trial court failed to obtain from him the specific contacts that may have occurred. Now, he's an advocate in this case on appeal and can't supplement the record. We don't have that information and cannot obtain that now because the trial court did not develop the record. And in fact, her decision simply states in one sentence at the end that looking at the record, it's clear that he, didn't provide inaccurate information and it wasn't material. And there's no discussion as to how she reaches that conclusion from the deposition.
Well, let's assume for a moment it doesn't take a lot of discussion to understand why the response wasn't inaccurate. Technically, it was accurate. But the real question is, why isn't it material that a person who's a victim of a crime that's scheduled for trial, pending trial is another way, of putting it, is allowed to join a panel of 12 to adjudicate a crime, related or not, and is expected to be objective and be able to reach a conclusion that someone is guilty or not guilty?
That's
how is that possible?
How do we
have confidence in the outcome?
You can't. And that's what this court has stated repeatedly, that part of the reason for a part of how we protect an impartial jury is also to ensure the confidence in the justice system. And when you have someone that's on the jury that is also a victim in another case that, by the way, had been scheduled to go to trial less than two weeks before this.
Put all the adequacy of the voir dire and the adequacy of the post-trial inquiry into the objectivity and lack of prejudice or bias on the part of the juror. Do you have a case that suggests that the mere fact that the victim of a crime sits on a jury, and not just the victim of a past crime, but an individual who's going to be testifying for the state in a future hearing is allowed to sit on the jury, is somehow a per se violation of due process, or shocks your conscience, or whatever phrase you want to pull off the shelf. Any case?
Unfortunately, Your Honor, I have not found such a case. What this court has decided is in cases such as Jackson versus State, where a juror was an uncle of a deputy attorney general, the Supreme Court said after the fact, almost essentially, that it was a per se violation, that we have a duty to safeguard.
But if we're going to get to that issue in this case, we would really be doing it under a plain error standard. And I assume your argument would be under a plain error standard of review that focuses on fundamental fairness and the integrity of the process. The plain error in this case was not asking the entire panel whether they had or are a victim of a crime.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. That's correct.
So that would become a per se rule in all criminal trials? Essentially, is that what you're saying?
Be a per se rule. That's correct. And then, of course, if the court did not want to make a per se rule, the court could look at to the individual circumstances, and certainly here, that would have been the case. That should have been asked.
Well, wait a second. If the problem is that there's, you know, a lack of confidence in the jury system and public trust and all that kind of thing, and that's why this cannot stand, then that's per se.
Yes.
And every trial from now on, you have to ask the jurors whether any of them have been or are victims of crimes.
That's
Alternatively, if it is a matter of concern that should be addressed in appropriate cases, then don't we have to look to the particular facts and say, was this the kind of situation where we can't be confident in the result because of the fact that one of the jurors had prior involvement?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would argue that the circumstances in this case would actually rise to that level.
Okay, but and I assumed you would, but what is it about this case where apparently the juror didn't realize that he knew, I mean, he didn't know, but, you know, so he didn't realize that there was any problem with the way he had answered the question, and he goes ahead and remains part of the jury. What is it about this case that makes it one of those where you just have to have a new trial?
Well, first of all, it was the same prosecutor. Mr. Carroll was prosecuting the juror's case as well as this case.
But the juror didn't know that.
No, but if the court's looking to a per se rule with respect to protecting the integrity of the judicial system, on its face, the fact that the same prosecutor is prosecuting both.
Do we know whether the prosecutor knew at the point that this trial was taking place that he was going to be the prosecutor for the juror's case? Because I understand that cases get flipped around pretty quickly.
He did know from the record. It appears he knew because he did do a motion for continuance at one point, and there had been case reviews, so he would have known that he was the prosecutor in both. However, he did not know, there was nothing improper about what Mr. Carroll did. He did not know that the juror that was being seated was the alleged victim. They had not met face-to-face.
So he knew the name of the defendant.
Correct.
But he didn't know who the victim was.
That's correct. And, I'm sorry.
Well, even if he didn't know the victim, he didn't know that this juror was the victim.
Correct.
Didn't put the two names together.
Right.
Right. There's nothing in the record to suggest that. No. In fact, the record reflects he did exactly what he should have done.
That's correct.
When he found out how things had gone awry.
That's exactly right, and I believe I pointed that out. And he brought it to the court's attention, but that does not take away the problem with the situation itself, which is that we've got a juror who's sitting on a case who's also an alleged victim.
Should the focus be to get to Justice Berger's question, and I'm not confident you've answered it.
Okay.
Is there a distinction between have you ever been the victim of a crime and someone sitting on a jury who is conscious of the fact that they are a victim in a pending trial and have a meeting coming up in the next few days, 10 days, I think the record says, with a prosecutor to discuss the prosecution of the case in which they are a victim.
Yes.
Is that a particularly
yes.
distinguishable circumstance?
Absolutely. And just so the record's clear, I don't know that there was an actual scheduled meeting at the time that he was seated. However, there was this is why I keep bringing this up. 2 weeks before, the trial had been scheduled and had been rescheduled to the end of the same month. So it is clear that he would at least know he's got a trial in the same time with the Attorney General's office.
Maybe I misunderstood, but I thought the letter that came from the Attorney General's office was telling him that he was going to be meeting with the Deputy Attorney General on a date certain. Is that not correct?
No, I believe what happened, and Mr. Carroll can correct me if I'm wrong, what I believe happened was 5 days after the verdict, he called the alleged victim and said, we need to talk about your case. And so he came in and met with Mr. Carroll, and that's when the juror said, oh, I was on your case.
Okay, so the letter only concerned the trial date. Is that what you're telling us?
Yes, I'm not sure what letters, because Mr. Carroll did not put that on the record as a witness, as to what exactly was sent to the...
All right, but what we do know is this juror was not simply the victim of a
right.
past concluded
That's correct.
Crime. This is someone who's sitting on a criminal case with the understanding they will be fair and objective, free of any prejudice against a criminal defendant, capable of doing justice, yet the trial in which they were a victim in a criminal case is on the docket in the very near future.
Yes, that's exactly right. And so, therefore, the... it is a harmless, not a harmless error problem, and so under the plain error standard, if the court wants to go that route, it is a per se violation, and therefore Ms. Knox should have gotten a new trial.
All right, now I understand the trial judge never explained why she found that it was not material that this juror was on this trial and with his own trial pending, so to speak. What's your argument that it was material?
It was material because what would have happened is if he had provided the accurate information, then the court would have probably learned that Mr. Carroll was the same prosecutor in his case. That goes to what this court concluded in Hall, albeit different circumstances, where in Hall, this court said, look, the corrections officer had an interest in the outcome of that case because he's interested in deterrence in the prison. Somewhat attenuated, and here we have a less attenuated situation, I would argue, because he's going to have the Attorney General's office, at the very least, even if he doesn't know it's Mr. Carroll, he wants success in that case, and he did acknowledge that in his deposition, and he wants success in his case, and of course he would want the Attorney General's office to be happy, for lack of a better word.
Well, is there any distinction to be made between the fact that this case is, about which we're here, is a bad check case, and that the juror in question's case was, a robbery case?
No, they're both crimes of dishonesty. I know that the state tried to distinguish them, saying one was a crime of violence and this one wasn't, but they are both crimes of dishonesty, and so therefore they are similar in nature.
You're in your rebuttal time. Do you want to save it?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. For the record, Kevin M. Carroll appearing on behalf of the State. When James Pritchard was seated as juror number 8 in State versus DeShonta Knox.
Excuse me one second.
Yes, Your Honor.
I have, perhaps I've screwed the clock up, but the program number 2 started in the red. I'm not technologically proficient enough.
Well, if the Court has no other questions, I'll.
You get extra time to think.
I'm not sure.
Now it's going. Sorry.
Thank you, Your Honor. When James Pritchard was seated as juror number 8 in this incident matter, I did not recognize him, and he did not recognize me. When I met with Mr. Pritchard on March 25th, 2009, it was approximately 1 week after the DeShonta Knox trial had been concluded and the jury returned a verdict. That meeting was scheduled on March 23rd, again, after the Knox case had been resolved. He recognized me at the meeting on the 25th. Again, I did not recognize him. He brought it to my attention. I thanked him for doing so and told him, essentially, I have to disqualify myself from this case. I left that meeting and immediately informed the court. And what happened next was the investigation into whether there was any juror misconduct or juror bias.
What was the letter? What do you mean by the letter? What was the letter?
The letter that I sent to Judge Johnson, the trial judge in this case, and that is...
Tell us about any correspondence between the AG's office and this juror before the trial about which we're here, and whether or not that correspondence mentioned your name, trial date, or anything related to the case.
Your Honor, my notes indicate, and this is in the letter that I had sent to the Superior Court on March 25th, 2009, docket item 25, indicated that I was not aware of any contact that I had with him personally. Now, typically, for the Department of Justice, it is ordinary for us to have contact and send out form letters to victims as a prosecution proceeds. We let them know when the court date is. We oftentimes are letters that are sent out indicating who the prosecutor is.
That's fine, but what happened here? Was there correspondence from the Attorney General's office to the juror before the trial?
I believe that there was a victim services letter that was sent, not from me. I don't believe it identified the prosecutor by name or me by name.
You don't know?
I do not know off the top of my head, no, Your Honor. That's something that's not handled by the individual prosecutors.
No, I appreciate that, but it is handled by the Attorney General's office.
Yes, right? Your Honor, by the Victim Services Unit of the Attorney General's office.
So we don't know, then, what the letter said?
There are typical letters that do go out that are form letters that alert the victims of a crime.
I don't mean to be rude, but I don't want to know about the typical letter. I want to know whether the record reflects what the letter said, if there was one, that went to the juror before the trial about which we're here.
I don't believe the record does reflect that, and I'll do candor to the court. I believe the juror...
How could an inquiry into what the juror knew or didn't know, or could be biased or prejudiced, how could it be complete without knowing that?
Well, that was the basis for the juror's deposition, which took place in this matter.
Right, so why don't you kind of give us the chronology? How did we move from the judge talking to the juror to the judge saying, take the deposition because, you know, it appears part of the problem with the deficiencies in this record relate to the fact that the judge didn't conduct the inquiry?
Well, Your Honor, in response to that, there was a motion for new trial filed on April 6th. That's reflected in docket item 26. The state's response was filed on June 1st of 2009. That's docket item 30. And in that, the state suggested that additional inquiry was appropriate. The court sent a letter to the juror, as reflected in docket item number 35, on September 17, 2009. A second letter went out on October 29, 2009, and that's reflected in docket item 36. I believe the next entry would have been the state's letter to the juror dated May 3, 2010. And that's docket item 37.
And what prompted the state to start corresponding with the juror?
That followed a office conference or a status conference in this matter that does not appear to be on the docket. Touching on Ms. Walker's concern, I'd be concerned about addressing that because that is not a part of the record here. That led to the court entering the order directing the parties to have contact with Mr. Pritchard, the juror, and to proceed with questioning him about the limited question of whether or not he knew me at the time of the Knox trial. So when we conducted that deposition, the order was in effect, and it was very narrowly tailored to what this sole question of whether he knew me.
So at the deposition, no one said to the juror, where's the letter you got about your case?
He was asked if he recalled receiving anything like that, and I believe the juror talked about, in just generalities, maybe receiving a letter and hoping that his case would be prosecuted, but he couldn't vividly or completely recall about that.
Can I assume that the Attorney General's office, the Victim Services Unit or whatever, doesn't routinely destroy the copies of letters that they sent out, or that they routinely retain letters that they sent out?
Again, I don't have the answer to that question just because I don't know their retention policies for the Victim Services Unit. I know that the letters that are sent out are form letters that are just, you insert the case name.
Would it be far-fetched to assume that they have some regular process for noting that they have sent the letter out?
I believe they do, Your Honor. I'm not completely certain on that, though, just because that's not within.
Yet nobody produced at this deposition a letter and sent it to the trial judge to explain what the juror did or did not know from the AG's office before this trial.
No, Your Honor. The deposition was aimed at resolving the factual question of whether or not the juror knew me. And
don't you find it a little surprising that the basis for the concern was ostensibly a letter the juror received, and that no one has put that letter in the record?
Your Honor, I think the basis of the concern was that not the receipt of a letter by the juror, but rather his familiarity, if he had any, with me, and whether that would have created a bias towards the state.
Why wasn't the basis of concern the fact that there was a juror whose vote was required to conclude a trial in a unanimous vote of 12, who was pending trial as a victim, ostensibly represented by the Attorney General's office, sitting on a trial in a criminal case where the Attorney General is a party, irrespective of who the Deputy Attorney General might be? Why wasn't that the concern?
Well, that was a concern, Your Honor. But again, the...
But you said the deposition was limited to an inquiry about whether or not the juror knew you as an individual.
Because that was in response to the questions asked during voir dire. Do you know the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, the defense counsel, other attorneys, or employees of their offices?
Did you participate in the deposition, or did another deputy handle the deposition?
I was present for it, but another deputy handled the actual questioning of the juror, just on the off chance that...
Present in the sense that you were not sequestered?
I was not sequestered, no. At that point, I had made my representation to the court that any contact I would have had with the juror prior to the Knox trial would have been ministerial.
Would it be fair to say that, at least until now, the issue was solely focused on whether this juror accurately answered voir dire question, and number two, even if technically there was an accurate answer, whether this juror knew you?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there wasn't any issue about the kinds of concerns that are being expressed by the court now with respect to how somebody could be neutral given his personal situation?
Yes, Your Honor. That accurately reflects the concern at the time.
Well, you recall that this court decided a case involving Banther a few years ago. One of the issues in that case was seating a juror, and one of the questions that was not answered related to whether anyone had been a victim of a violent crime.
Yes, sir.
So my question is, was that question, quote, you know, specifically asked for by one of the attorneys in that case, or is the violent crime question only asked in violent crime cases? And if you're not involved in a violent crime case, no one ever asked generally if you've ever been a victim of a crime. What's your understanding of when, if ever, people are asked if they're victims of a crime?
It's my understanding, Your Honor, that that's a routine question asked in a violent crime case. So, for example, Mr. Pritchard was the alleged victim of an robbery second degree. If this had been a robbery second degree case, I suspect that question would have been included.
As a matter of course.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the attorneys have a certain amount of leeway in requesting additional questions.
No, I understand that.
And I don't believe
I just want to know, when is a question relating to being the victim of a crime in the standard question that the court's going to ask without application?
I think right now, Your Honor, it's asked for violent crimes prosecutions. And would it have been beneficial in this case, a nonviolent crime prosecution, to ask that question? Clearly, the answer would have been yes. That would have certainly made the inquiry a little bit more, a little cleaner, and would have made the juror's failure to disclose that, if in fact he did that, all the more easier to identify and flesh out. But in this case, that particular question was not asked. It was not requested by either party, and it was not posed to the veneer.
Please tell us why we should be comfortable with the result knowing that there was a juror sitting among the 12 who was being represented by the Attorney General's office, even if knowledge of that fact came from nothing more than a putative form letter from the Victim Services Unit of the Attorney General's office, but knew that there was a trial pending in which his robbery case would be prosecuted by the AG's office. Why should we not be concerned about that as a matter of inherent fairness?
Your Honor, the court should be concerned with it. And in this case, I believe both the rules and the case law give the trial judges broad discretion in answering concerns like that. Rule 24A requires that the court shall conduct or permit such examination as is reasonably calculated to ascertain juror bias. To the extent
but doesn't that really talk about voir dire?
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. The second portion of Rule 24A specifically addresses the trial judge's responsibility for conducting that investigation during jury selection. But I think the first line, or that line that I quoted from 24A, pertains to all aspects of juror bias.
All right. Well, I'll ask you the same question I asked Ms. Walker. Do you know of any reported case or any other case where there was a post-trial hearing involving a juror that was not conducted by the judge?
I am not aware of any reported case, Your Honor, no.
What do you know of any other juror that's been deposed in the absence of a judge other than this case?
No, Your Honor. I think the case law that this court has come out with on these particular issues is clear that it gives broad discretion to the trial judge in resolving these issues. The court has
You're saying after a trial,
yes, sir,
our court has somehow indicated that a trial judge has broad discretion in inquiring into the conduct of jurors?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, when there's suspected juror bias or misconduct. In Caldwell and Weber, the court has talked about the judge's broad discretion to dismiss claims outright or to conduct full investigations.
What's your view of the trial judge's analysis of materiality here, and on what basis did she rationally conclude that this was immaterial?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that rests with the transcript of the deposition. The veneer was asked if they knew the attorneys or the employees of the Attorney General's office or defense counsel. Mr. Pritchard answered that, or he didn't answer that question or indicate that he didn't know anyone.
Well, when we review a trial judge, what we like to know is what facts on which she relied, what framework for analysis she used, and how she matched the facts to the framework for analysis to reach her conclusion. Where do we find that on the issue of materiality?
The order from the trial judge in this case was truncated, but the issue, the question at issue was very short and very pointed, and it was whether the juror knew me. The juror answered during the deposition that he did not know me from a can of paint.
Okay, so I understand that. So is that really the issue that gets to the heart of whether this was an untainted juror in an untainted trial in which we can have confidence that result was free of bias and prejudice?
I believe in this case, yes, Your Honor.
Tell us why, please.
One, Your Honor, goes back to what was posed to the veneer and whether or not the question at issue is whether the potential jurors knew any of the attorneys or employees. He answered no to that question. Additionally, during the deposition, he said that he did not know me from a can of paint. He also said that in discussing the verdict that
the jury... Aren't you assuming that the only question that's material to bias is whether or not the juror knew you personally? When in fact what we're dealing with is a juror who's currently represented by your office in a trial in which they're a victim that has yet to be held and is indisputably on that juror's mind, as that juror purports to sit as an independent, objective, neutral fact finder in a criminal case. Isn't that the issue?
I understand the court's concern with it, and that was an issue. I don't believe that was the issue presented below. I believe the issue presented below was limited to whether the jury knew.
From time to time in my 41 years of practice, I have noted that the issue presented below isn't really the issue in the case. Now, is this another one of those circumstances or not?
Your Honor, I don't think in this case the court necessarily has to address that. The issue, obviously looking at the way voir dire was conducted in this case and the issues that have flown from there, from here on out, it is the best practice to ask a question about whether or not a victim or a juror is a victim or has dealings with either party. That would allow voir dire to be more illuminating.
Let me try it another way. Why is this not reversible error?
Because, Your Honor, the juror did not answer the question inaccurately. The post-trial investigation revealed that he did not know me and that the juror decided the case on the facts and the evidence presented rather than who the parties were. There's a basis in the record.
But I think what the questions are trying to drive at is that we understand, we take it as a given, that this juror didn't know you and didn't know, have any feelings about you or any of the other parties to this case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
However, at no point was there questioning or consideration of what this juror's personal circumstances were vis-a-vis the Attorney General's office. That was not part of the deposition. That was not part of what the trial judge asked to find out. It was, or what the attorneys were interested in finding out. All that the attorneys were pursuing was, did this person actually know you and either answer falsely or in some other way mislead people? The answer to that was a resounding no, he didn't know you. So it seems that everyone at the trial level thought, well, that's the end of that problem. But apparently at no point until it got to this court was there any discussion of the separate question of whether it's appropriate for someone who's dealing as a victim with the Attorney General's office to be considered unbiased on another criminal jury panel. Is that a correct statement of where we are on this?
From my understanding of the court's questions, yes. And that's a concern that the court has. And what I can do is answer the issue that was presented below, and that's been raised on appeal.
Let's go with what we have in this record. We'll assume the juror answered the question as framed accurately.
That's right.
And we know the juror didn't know you. Normally there's a catch-all question at the end of the voir dire about do you have any other reason you can't participate in. We'll assume the jurors, we know the juror just sat there. If the trial judge had conducted this hearing rather than simply having a deposition, it's quite possible the trial judge would have said, well, now that we know you were going to be testifying as a victim to a trial not long after this, why didn't you come forward when you were asked? Is there any other reason why you shouldn't participate? Don't you think it's possible that would have been of concern to a judge?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. And that question was not answered or was not asked during the deposition, again, because it was the party's understanding, given the nature of the issue raised in the motion for a new trial, that the issue hinged on the juror's knowledge of me and whether that tainted him individually.
I understand that. But, you know, and my question is this unfolded? And the judge who conducted the voir dire did say to everyone, using the general question, is there any other reason that, you know, you should not be seated on this case? And then if the judge had been conducting the post-trial hearing, the judge would have said, well, knowing you're going to go to trial in a couple of weeks because you got this letter that said you're going to go to trial, why didn't you come up and tell me that you were going to be testifying at your own trial where you were the victim in a couple of weeks?
I agree with that, Your Honor. My understanding was that the juror, during the deposition, briefly touched on his hope that the case would be prosecuted, but that he really didn't know what was going on with it and that he had decided the case on the evidence presented.
You're out of time, but I have one more question. What are the odds that if defense counsel had known that this juror was the victim in a pending criminal case about to be represented by the Attorney General's office, that with that knowledge, regardless of the trial judge's view of materiality, that a peremptory challenge would have been directed at that juror? What are the odds?
Your Honor, I don't know the odds. What I can tell you is that we're talking apples and oranges between the prosecutions. One was a violent crime prosecution. The other one was a nonviolent issuing bad check case. I don't have an answer for you in terms of what it is.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The odds are pretty good that they would have exercised that.
That was his question.
Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. I do want to point out that Mr. Armstrong, in his original motion, and as the court has so well pointed out, we've lost track of the initial issue here. And in his initial motion, he actually asserted the former juror failed to disclose that he was a victim in a matter for which the Attorney General's office was currently prosecuting. And so, as the court pointed out, everyone lost track of that all the way, perhaps until today, when this court has come forward and actually identified the issue.
But
and
when you're talking about that failure to disclose, you'd still have to connect it to a question. And if we assume that the question that's the subject matter of this appeal was ambiguous enough that it was answered accurately, then we're left with the catch-all question at the end, right?
Right. And in the, yes, and the concern here then goes to this court's proposition that this is a plain error, under a plain error standard, this would be a per se rule that the individual was actually a victim at the time, and it was impending and could not be fair. And the discretion of the trial court was limited when she was doing the analysis here, and she was not able to assess the demeanor correctly, and because she didn't conduct the questioning, it is likely we failed to find that it was intentional.
Thank you, Ms. Walker.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Take the case under advisement and recess.
Rise.